other 80%, turning your church's spectators into participants.
The real goal for today is not to sell books, even though I'll keep hinting at that all day. but it really is to try to get you to think differently about involvement and participation in the congregation. And as we hint in the title, those folks who are not so involved in the congregation. Hopefully you'll walk away from here with some new thoughts, new ideas, a different way of looking at some of this.
Okay. He's Scott. I'm Warren. Our outline today is going to follow the outline of the book. We're going to talk about listening. We're going to talk about learning. And then we'll talk about leading. To start, Howard Meyer, we'd like to welcome you. And you're going to start us off this morning. Read our parable.
And he gathered his disciples around him and talked to them, saying, there was a shepherd tending his flock. One evening, during his count, he discovered that one sheep from his flock of 100 had gone astray and was missing. Not to worry, he thought, I still have 99. Their will sustain me and my family. After all, the missing sheep was not so productive anyway. In the morning, he led the remaining sheep to a familiar green pasture. Several sheep were tired of the same grass, the same bubbling brook, and the same weekly routine, so they decided to wander over the knoll and off to another seemingly greener meadow dotted with buttercups and clover. The shepherd called out to them, but they didn't heed his pleas. His faithful border collie attempted to round up the errant members of the flock to no avail. After a while, the shepherd whistled in the collie, saying, come on back. They will return on their own this evening. If not, I'm sure some other shepherd will find them and care for them. Over the coming weeks, a few of the wayward sheep returned, but a few more also wandered off following the norm set by others. Perhaps they assumed that the other pastures must be pleasant indeed, since so few of their friends had returned. Perhaps they simply did not want to participate regularly with the flock. Whenever the shepherd saw them, he invited them back, but eventually gave up. They'll come if they're hungry, he decided. When shearing day arrived, the flock had dwindled to just 42. A dozen had amounts of wool that were quite unproductive and were hardly worth shearing. 10 were still lambs and needed their undeveloped wool coats to survive the cold evenings. Thus the shepherd sheared the remaining 20 productive sheep, bagged their wool, and took it to market. On the way home, the shepherd thought about the 20 sheep that had developed healthy wool coats. He pondered why his total flock hadn't been more productive this year and how his family would survive on his meager income. Perhaps, he thought, if I could just entice some sheep from my neighbor's flock to join my flock, then all would be well. Or maybe I could find a few of the remaining wild rams on the mountainside. So off he went to try.
Thank you, Howard. We begin the book with that parable, in part to get at the part of the reason why it exists. Over the years, both Warren and I have taught MDiv students and Doctor of Ministry students and had many conversations with clergy related to the question of many of us may have 300 people on our membership rolls, but we hardly ever see more than 100 in worship service. And barely even that amount who are actively engaged and involved in the life of the congregation. And often the question comes up when I talk to pastors or when Warren talks with pastors around this idea of the Pareto principle. You know, 20% of the people do 80% of the work and 80% do next to nothing. And it's often offhandedly said like, well, you know, of course, that's a law. That's one of the Ten Commandments of pastoring is, you know, we only get 20% of our people. And it has always kind of galled me in a sense that we're willing to live with that of sorts. So we feel bad about it, and yet I heard from clergy after clergy, I don't quite know how to reach those folks. So we wrote this book to really make clergy even more guilty, make them feel even worse about being a minister. Not really. I mean, you have to have some guilt. You have to, you're right? I mean, that's what religion's all about. But we also wanted to say, what does the research show about trying to connect these people? And how can we think of research-based ways of structuring the congregation and our programs and our efforts so as to try to draw this 80% in, these other folks who are marginally involved, minimally involved, or have discontinued involvement, and yet they still maintain that membership. They still have some connection to the congregation. And so that's what we want to wrestle with today. Now, if indeed roughly 80 to 85% of Americans say that they're Christian, and 60 to 65% say that they have a congregation that they're affiliated with, and 40% lie on surveys and say they attended this past week, when in fact only about 20% really showed up that last week in services, and 10% of those are really actively involved in the life of the congregation. And as most of you clergy know, maybe only 2.5% of those people really actually do work or show up at a workshop on Tuesday morning. In fact, if you're looking to create a more vital congregational life, it makes more sense in our mind to look at the vast millions of people who are already committed, in some sense, to membership to these congregations than it does to go out and look for the uncommitted, unchurched, small percentage of people in the United States. The vast majority of Americans have some commitment to a congregation, however marginal it is. So if you go looking for those, in fact, as our parable says, you're really circulating the saints. You're really trying to get somebody else's mediocre sheep. So why not try to get your own marginal sheep and find a way to create a more vital commitment and connection, since they already do have some connection to the congregation? That's what we are trying to play with in this book.
And if we break that down into percentages, we all know about the 20% who are the most involved, the core that show up, that participate the most. But we need to think about other percentages. There's a 20% that was part of the core that's moving away from the core. There's another 20% that's moving toward the core. There's yet another 20% that you can't reach, but somebody else in your church can. And there's a final 20% that we're not entirely sure God is going to reach, but is still on your list. Now, that's a gross overgeneralization. But all that to say, you know a lot about your 20% that's most involved. But we hope, through the other 80%, that you'll get a window on these other 20%. On these other sections of the church, those moving especially towards involvement, those moving away from core involvement, those are really crucial to hear and understand. And we want to help you learn how to do that. And in so doing, the flock becomes more involved. My favorite quote in the book says, "If you pay attention to those who are less involved, they will become more involved." And the good news is they will say that they have spiritually grown. There's a relationship, a strong relationship, between participation and their statements of spiritual growth.
So in the first third of the book, we take up the task of listening. Because, in fact, the only way you know why your people are here, why they're connected, why they're disconnected, why they've almost disaffiliated, is to go ask them and listen to them. So we suggest that most churches should actually create a listening team and should make the effort to go out, knock on doors, sit down, talk to people at coffee hour, and find out what it is that motivates them to be a part, to be involved. And the way we did this in the book was to take three relatively new data sets of information from individuals who are in congregation. And together, these three data sets, one from very large congregations, one from a national random sample of congregations, and the third from the Hartford Institute inventories that we offer for pastoral search, church planning. Together, it was well over 100,000 people who answered questions about why they were involved, how they were connected, were they growing spiritually, were they increasing or decreasing their participation. We looked at all of those and we created a scale of involvement that included attending and giving and volunteering and participating in groups and ministries and inviting people. And we put them all together and then we put them out across the continuum of not very involved or not involved hardly at all to very involved. And we broke those into groups and said, well, what are the characteristics here that distinguish these groups one from another, related to the questions of, do I feel like I'm part of this place? Do I feel like my spiritual life's growing? How long had they been there? All of these other characteristics that we thought were a part of this. We listened to the speakers in those surveys. We also did field studies of a dozen or more congregations. We had countless focus groups with people who were newcomers, who had been their congregations a long time. We also had open-ended questions in the survey that gave a rich amount of data, because then we could look at the comments of folks who had been disaffiliated from the congregation and what were they saying, and those people who were most involved, what were they saying about their spiritual life and their involvement in the congregation. We listened, and from that we learned many things that we have written out, especially in the listening chapter. But we don't want you just to take our word for it and say, oh, well, they found these things, so obviously that's the case in our congregation. What we argue in the listening section is that all congregations need to contextualize all of this material. We don't think that we can create a program that you can all apply to your individual congregations and they'll all work. That's not how social dynamics of congregations are. You have to take ideas and thoughts and embed them in your own life and see what's happening in our congregation, and then the solutions come out of that are contextualized for your setting. It's based on who you are and where you are.
Who are the segments of your congregation and the spiritual connection that is behind most people's involvement? So now you want to take not just the national studies that we found, but now you want to say, all right, what about my church? How do I create a listening team that can hear what's going on? And really, the most important thing this listening team is fishing for is, tell us your story of involvement. Where did it increase? Where did it decrease? And how is that impacting your spiritual growth? Now, that sounds real simple, and actually it is. So in the book, we don't give you a whole lot of questions to ask. We talk more about, how do you structure such a thing? Well, the clergy don't need to be the ones to lead the team. You can if you want to. But if you have some loyal people with good listening skills who would enjoy the challenge of listening to the congregation and connecting, because it's going to take a lot of time, then deploy them. Make sure they're on board with the big idea of what you're doing and why. And then ultimately you're tasking them to connect with as many people as possible. In a smaller congregation, it's easy to connect with every single person in the congregation, or at least to attempt to. In a medium-sized congregation, you can connect with a majority of the households associated with it. In a larger congregation, you may need to do a kind of survey mixed with some focus group. The gist of what you want to come up with is to find out where people are in this involvement spectrum and why. Because again, the voices that you hear most readily are the most involved. And they influence you, because it's very easy to assume that the people that are the most involved represent everybody else, and they don't. In fact, the people who are most involved have probably been there a while. So if I ask those people, tell me how you connected with this congregation, tell me what it is you liked about this church most that drew you in, it may be an entirely different reason than what's engaging people now. And really, the most crucial group to inform your perspective on the church are those who are engaging right now. You want to know why. And those who are moving away, you want to know why. So the PR of such a group, you do not want to have the word get out that the pastor or the church board is making a list of the sheep and the goats in our congregation. Rather, more diplomatically, You want to say things like an elevator speech, a credible and helpful description of what you're doing, short enough that it can be voiced on an elevator ride. Like, we are reaching out to and listening to everyone in the church, from the most active to the least active. Or the church board created a short-term listening team who will try to help the church's leadership improve its understanding of the congregation's needs. Things like that are very positive. And then what you or your listeners will discover is when you sit down with someone and you say, would you tell us a little of your story of involvement? You know, what drew you in? What have you been involved with lately? What's pushed you away? You're going to get a torrent. We all love to be listened to. And so now this team not only has to listen and in some way record, but then you also have to be prepared to act on the things you learn. Because if you're hearing, well, the pastor this, or the church board that, or I was hurt by, or, you know, we really should do such and such, you need to in some way validate, not that you can do everything that people are asking, but in some way validate to say, I hear you and I want you to know, I'm going to report what you've said to an appropriate person. I'm going to pass this along, whatever level of confidentiality that you need to assess. But a listening team is just that. It goes out, it listens to the congregation, it comes back and it analyzes, what did we learn from those who are the most involved, who are moving toward involvement, who are moving away from involvement, and who aren't involved at all, and want to tell us about it. That's what the listening team is all about. The strength is not in how you do it. The strength is in hearing as much as you can and then in analyzing what you've heard.
Especially that's true, I think, when you're looking at the highly involved and, you know, kind of the moderately involved, because what you're trying to get there is not their level of involvement. You can almost eyeball that. What you're trying to get there is, what is it that's motivating them to be involved, and are they fulfilled by their involvement? You know, because there are many of us that are willing to participate, but it's a drudgery, or, you know, we do it because the pastor asked us to, but it doesn't make it passionate deep inside us. And so you want to try to tease those kinds of things out of those relatively involved people. And that's fairly easy to do in a focus group, in a group interview. And you have the natural settings of Sunday school or a prayer group or women's group or something like this that you can draw upon. When it gets to the people who are much less involved, then you're probably going to have to make the effort, maybe 8 times, to go to them and find out. And then I think it's probably best done interpersonally, one-on-one, or, you know, two people go out and talk. Because then it really is a pastoral care visit, in a sense.
Right. When you do the pizza with the pastor equivalent or whatever, who's going to come? The most involved. So you have to think up, really intentionally think of ways, all right, how do we reach out to those, the pastoral visit type thing, who aren't involved?
Let me say real quick, because we do have congregations of different sizes here, obviously if you have a congregation of 700, 800 in attendance, that means you probably have a congregation of 3,000 perhaps. So we also suggest in the book that it is impossible to go visit all of those people personally, perhaps. And that's where surveys come in, open-ended kinds of questions. And in fact, doing what we did with many different congregations, and we include in the back of the book some sample questions that you might use on a simple SurveyMonkey online questionnaire or paper questionnaire, or even a phone interview. So there are different strategies for different size congregations. And in fact, what you're doing with the listening team, especially with people who have drifted away, you're going to uncover disappointments. Some of the survey comments that we heard just broke our heart. I had been a member of this congregation for 35 years. My spouse was dying. The church rallied around me. My spouse died, and nobody comes to visit. And he drove, and I can't go anywhere. You know, I mean, that, you know, that's painful to read over and over again. What you're beginning to do with the listening team is to create a structure of accountability. So these are not just notes jotted down. What we're suggesting is, in fact, a database of sorts on the entire membership, very confidentially handled with utmost care, but you're beginning to track the spiritual lives and involvement and maturity of the people. Without some sort of accountability for the individuals, it's easy to allow those sheep to drift away and, oh, well, they'll come back. The higher level of accountability, and this doesn't have to be a database. It could be someone who is a partner, a buddy system of some sorts, that I hold you accountable, you hold me accountable. But you don't go to the tremendous effort to try to bring somebody back and then just leave them. You have to find ways to keep measuring and thinking about, are they growing? Are they progressing? And if not, what are we doing to reach out to them or to not answer their needs?
That person may end up being in that final 20% that you're not going to connect with. And let's be realistic, there will be many. But how much better to have reached out and tried and it not worked than not to have reached out at all? But also, we heard consistently from the different segments, people saying, I would like to reconnect. Now maybe they don't have all don't have the functionality to reconnect. But the heart's desire is, I would like to be re-engaged with my church. I would like to be reconciled. I would like to have a stronger connection. I would like to have greater spiritual vitality myself. And our sense is that by casting this wide net, you will reach a certain number of people who just needed that re-engagement, and as Scott says, the ongoing change that affects them. Later, in just a minute, we'll talk about those with soccer games and other things and what you're competing against, and really understanding what your church is up against, because there are ways that we can adjust to understand some of the cultural challenges that we're facing.
That question actually exemplifies this challenge that we all face, and we tend to think of it in interpersonal ways. Kirk Hathaway has written a very interesting study of the non-participants, and he says that there's a group of nominal members, there's a group of indifferent members, and then there's a group of estranged members. And you're probably never going to reach the nominal ones or the indifferent ones, but the estranged ones, because they have this passion, that church, they still have a love for it, right? I mean, there's still emotion there that can be tapped into. And what we found in our data, as Warren said, was even in those who I described before said, the church hasn't reached out to me for decades and, I've been in need. Those people still have a real longing to have the congregation reach back out to them. And while it may not be easy, you can repair some of that causes that estrangement. But it's not only, as I said, and Warren hinted, about interpersonal relationships or the dynamic between pastors and parishioners. There's also this cultural dimension, the context in which we're in, that has a profound effect on involvement, participation, volunteering. And that's what we really want to address in the second third of the book that we call the learning section, learning about the congregation and its context. In that, we talk about the changes to culture and to society and the influences that we're all up against, the larger barriers that hinder involvement that we can't necessarily do anything about. There's tremendous encroachment on the sacred Sunday time. I mean, there was a point at which nothing else took place Sunday morning. Most of you can remember that time. That time no longer exists. But we can't go to the soccer teams and say, hey, enough, let us have these 2 hours. You have the rest of the time. It doesn't work. Well, maybe it does. I don't know if any of you have ever tried it. Some congregations in the South have done that, and they were willing to shift. Okay, well, maybe it's not going to work here. But it's not just about sports. In most sprawl cities, the growing cities in the country, people are commuting, perhaps even here. People are commuting an hour, hour and a half each way. That eats into family time. So then where do they get the commitment, the committed, involved, intimate family time? On the weekends. So if your congregation doesn't give that family a way to create spiritual, committed family time, then they're going to say, hey, you know, we'd rather do something as a family on Sunday morning than come to church and be split up because we have so little of this. Likewise, if you have blended families, mixed families, mobility where you don't live in the same communities, well, when can you go visit grandparents? When can you go visit step-parents? Well, on the weekend. All of those things pull at the fabric of what we have traditionally thought of as a little community, all living around the church. Sunday morning, we all stroll there. It doesn't exist anymore, but it's things that we can't do anything about. Likewise, Robert Putnam has written, I'm sure many of you have read, Bowling Alone. There's clearly a change in American society that diminishes civic engagement, diminishes civic involvement. Now, there's some debate on whether that's completely true, but clearly the word volunteer has taken on a bit of a negative context, right? So we have to think about it in a different way because volunteering isn't something I passionately do for many, many people. Now, it might be for all of you in this room, but it also taps into all kinds of other emotions and passions that volunteer, that term, doesn't quite get at. And so we have to begin to think about that. Likewise, the rampant individualism in our society and the consumerism in our society has turned our world into a time when we talk about fulfilling my spiritual needs, having it my way. Our service has to be meaningful, not to the world, to me. It has to be significant to me. Well, most of our congregations are not set up to think about participation and involvement with that concept in mind at all. We're not marketing a product that people subscribe to, but in fact, that's the world that we now live in. So, what we suggest in the book is to begin to think about creating a learning team where you begin to understand some of the patterns and dynamics of some of this. Warren, tell us about some of the challenges faced by one congregation.
Well, I want to tell one of the stories from our book because that'll kind of give you a vivid picture if you don't have one already in your own context. Part of the research for this book, we would fly out typically on a Saturday, spend all the way until the following Wednesday, 4 days later, at a church. And we would just do everything. We'd start with the worship service, hang out, go to, if it had multiple services, and then we'd do the focus groups and all. One of the churches we visited, a growing church, was in Austin, Texas. And we got there early Sunday morning to watch the setup team put everything into place. And we stayed there until late evening through all the services and everything. That was probably the most at-church day that either of us had ever done in terms of from like 6 a.m. to like 8 in the evening. We had a few stretch breaks as we did it and two short drives to nearby restaurants for meals. And as we viewed the landscape, we were amazed at the competition. So here's what this church had. And again, the moral of the story is they figured out a way around it. First, even getting to their meeting place was a bit challenging since there was a 10K run that morning to raise money and awareness for a local charity. And so the route to church was cordoned off, and just getting there was a challenge. The location bordered a public park along a river, and so in the morning we easily watched 100 people unload their boats, fishing rods, picnic blankets, kites, frisbees, bicycles, and other gears for a happy day at the park. And many seemed to come as families. And then there were two athletic fields of a high school nearby, and all day long we saw people come and go to soccer games. And at lunch, we waited in line, and we wanted to tell them that there was no line at church. Thank you, God. And that the music was better at the church, too, than at lunch. But as we drove to and from our meals, we saw yard sales and all kinds of other things. And so, as Scott has said, in yesteryear, everything came to a halt on Sunday mornings, but not here. So this church had figured out a way to win against the competition. And it was not just the obvious, but it was subtle things as well.
I mean, they had all of this competition, this section of the book. We talk about these dynamics, and we say, okay, some of these things at least can be tried to change, but many of these larger cultural and societal factors, you have to ask yourself, how do we work around these things? How do we create new ways of being engaged and involved? And we'll talk about this in the leadership section, but how do we reconfigure our congregation so as to take account of the changes that have taken place over the last 40 or 50 years? And I dare say most congregations haven't thought about that in the last 40 or 50 years. We thought about it when everybody came back from the war and lots of people were having babies. Then we were happy to accommodate to the changes taking place in society. But society and the world has gradually changed since the 60s. And most of our congregations haven't gotten desperate enough, perhaps, to say, what we have to do differently. And we clearly have to say that. And those things we can't change, we have to adapt to. And if we don't adapt, then we're going to go the way of the dinosaurs. But it's not just out there in the culture. It's not just out there in society. It is also the case that within our congregations, there are patterns and actions and behaviors that cause roadblocks to participation even within our congregations. And we have to recognize those and realize that there are better practices, perhaps, that lead to participation than some of the things that we do. And many of these things we can't do much about. For instance, I mentioned earlier size, right? The smaller you are, the more likely you are to have high percentages of people who are both members and participants. So if you're under 50, there's a good chance that you might have 70% of your people who are members also attending. And as you get larger and larger, you get decreasing percentages of people. Well, short of growing your church or killing your church, you can't do a whole lot about size immediately. I mean, hopefully it's a byproduct of more of your people coming back. But likewise, theology. You know, we often see reports about the conservative Christian world growing or, you know, mainline in decline. But in fact, we found very little, much less than we thought, distinctions across theological. The same was with worship. There was some difference in contemporary worship versus more traditional worship. But again, not nearly as much as we thought there might be related to participation and involvement. On the other hand, less conflict in the congregation increase the level of participation and involvement. Okay, so have less conflict. That's not always the easiest thing. Maybe it's easier to grow than it is to not have conflict, or maybe they both are the same. Even more distinctive, I think, some of the roadblocks that we found were ideas like defining what individuals' gifts were. Did the church assist me in understanding my gifts and my calling and my special abilities and what I could give the church? If the church data said they did, or if the individual said they did, participation and involvement went up. Well, how hard is that to do? There are countless gift inventories, and we list a number of them in the back of the book. Likewise, if a congregation not just helped people discover their gifts, but then gave them training and mentoring and gave them a way to live out their gifts, participation and involvement went up. So how difficult is that? If you said, well, occasionally we do training, participation went down. Oh, no, we never do training, participation and involvement went even further down. So how simple? But it's these sort of artificial roadblocks that congregations put up because that's the way it's always been done. You know, we don't have to reward our volunteers. You know, volunteering is its own reward. And yet the data shows that all you have to do is say, wouldn't you like to be trained? Wouldn't you like to go to this conference and get some new skills? That alone is enough reward and pat on the back that people then want to volunteer more. The more likely you are to reward, to acknowledge, to affirm, to support people participating and being involved, the more likely they are to be involved and participating. Additionally, as I said earlier, you know, we often spend an enormous amount of time creating a team of people who are greeters, and we think about how we go about inviting people in and getting people connected when they come as new people. We almost never have a hospitality team at the back door who say, oh, you're leaving? Why are you leaving? You're drifting away. What's going on? Is there something that we can do? Why aren't we meeting your needs? What's wrong here? There's a revolving door in the back, so it doesn't matter how many of our folks come in the front and get warmly welcomed. If they can just slip out the back without any hesitation, that's what you find. So as I said, after 2 years, you begin to see a decrease in the level of participation and involvement. We have to begin to think about what are our roadblocks that we have in our own programmatic forms that we create around our congregation that hinder people from staying engaged and continuing that engagement.
So just to underscore, think about how much energy you put into newcomers and helping them get connected. What if you put a similar thought into people who have been there 5 years? And just think about that group. How do we re-engage them? How can we meet their spiritual needs? Are their spiritual needs different than those just coming in the door? While some things may be obvious that you can do immediately, like what you applaud, you get more of, as Scott mentioned, the things that you cheer and reward and affirm, you'll see people rise to the challenge. What we learned from our interviews and research was that there's a disconnect in another area, and that is how people get involved. In many of the churches, we ask the pastors the same questions we ask the people. And we ask the pastors, how do you think your congregation's going to respond? So, for example, we said, here are 6 different ways people can get involved in church. How do you think your congregation will say they got involved? Clergy consistently rated the pulpit announcement as the number one thing. If we just announce it, and that's fed by people saying, well, look, Pastor, if you just announce the whatever, you know, then people will come. Because the congregation, many feel that their program can be helped by that pulpit announcement. But what people told us was it was a relational connection that got them involved. I was asked by somebody I knew. Now think about that. If you have a new whatever, a new Bible study, a new spiritual adventure of some kind, how could you have people be invited by someone they know? It's very doable. Everybody in the congregation knows somebody. But it's a whole different approach to networking. I'll give you a case in point. We're launching a new small group series. Do I do a pulpit announcement to say, okay, you know, we're looking for leaders and blah, 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 and, you know, it's wonderful and you get the most out of it and all the benefits, which is fine. But what if the existing leaders were just as heavily involved in the recruitment and they went to their friends and said, you know, you would be a really good small group leader. I know you can do it. I've seen you over the years, you've got the skills, God has given you appropriate gifts, I know you can do it. In the surveys, people would say that it was that friend tugging them much more than the pulpit announcement, which all goes back to we're giving you kind of a scattershot of ideas, not all of which will work, and you have to figure out which ones will and which ones won't for your context. But what we're wanting to do overall is to say, okay, we do a great, it's much easier to listen to the newcomers than to those who are here, and it's much easier to learn from the newcomers than those who are already there. So we're wanting to get you to think about what it would look like to learn from those who are already there. And in doing so, we're convinced you'll find that there's a pattern, that there are patterns of the people who are there that could work better, that could connect better, that could be better involved, and as a result, say that they feel a greater sense of spiritual growth. But you're going to have to make some intentional adjustments.
One of the things that we found by talking to and surveying, especially the relatively new people in the congregation, the question, as Warren said, what moved you from spectator to participant? You know, what was it, what path did you take to get involved? And there wasn't any one path that we suggested that garnered more than about 25%. Essentially, what we found was that people came in many different ways to connect into the life of the congregation. You know, so it's not they move from first base to second base to third base, or it's not, you
even
know,
if your program says that that's how you're supposed to do it.
And that's what we found when we talked to the staff, right? When we surveyed the staff, it was like, oh, well, we have this program that they move from A to, you know, or they move from class 101 to class 102 to class 103, and they get this and they do that.
And maybe 30% did.
Yeah. However, most of the people were coming from some other way. And Warren even pushed a couple people. Oh, well, what is your program? Oh, well, we do this. Well, how did you become involved in the life of this congregation? Oh, well, I did something completely different.
At one church, everybody gave me the party line. Well, we have this thing on Wednesday nights, and that's, you know, because I said, if I was a newcomer here, because I was, and I thought that God wanted me to be more involved in the church, you know, how would I do it? Every single person gave me the party line. They got it. They've been trained. But then, you know, I'd chat for a minute, and I'd say, oh, by the way, how did you get involved? And not a one of them got involved that way.
So, in fact, our perception, if we're staff or we're lay leaders or we're the clergy, of how the dynamic of our congregation and involvement and participation works is a staff-oriented, it is a programmatic-oriented kind of. But in fact, if you go listen to what people say, how they got connected, it was, oh, well, you know, I started working at the soup kitchen, or I did this program that you had, and then, you know, I got connected with this person, and then I came in. It's not at all like we tend to structure our programs to drive people down a funnel, right? It's the opposite way in some sense. They might come in the front door, but they come in connected to countless different ways. And we clearly saw this in the mega churches, where there were hundreds of different doors into the life of the congregation and the building, for that matter. One of the other things that we found was that oftentimes the staff and the clergy overemphasized, not to counter what Warren just said, but they overemphasized the more programmatic ways of getting involved. The comments from the pulpit, the comments by staff asking you to do something, and vastly underemphasized the two factors that we had in the survey that tapped into individual initiative. One of those said, I felt this stirring kind of spiritual call to get involved. And the other was, I just was determined to get involved. I made an intentional effort, kind of one more secular and one more sacred. Those were almost non-existent on the staff perception. But in fact, when we started to look at what of these different paths most directly related to robust participation. It was these individualistic, the internal dynamics of wanting to get involved, either for spiritual reasons or because I felt this, you know, sense of just jumping in and doing it. That was especially true among the megachurch attenders. That, you know, if you wanted to get involved in a megachurch, you had to be intentional about it. It was a passion and a drive, whether spiritual or just human, coming from within the person. And the programs and the other kinds of announcements by the staff weren't as important as something going on inside the person. And here again, we make that connection to this whole sense of spiritual fulfillment, and I'm meeting my spiritual needs here, and this causes me to have a passion and an intensity that makes me not want to volunteer, but want to live out this sense of calling and this mission and this desire to live as God wants us to live. So what we clearly saw when we started looking at the staff and the programmatic roadblocks, in a sense, at the churches, is that people were coming in all these ways, and the church was all saying this way, and it was a complete chasm between the two. So it's not surprising that we only reach 20 or 30%. One of our other surveys asked this really interesting question. You know, first, there's a list of 16 different things, and it says, you know, what's the best thing this church does? And there's complete agreement about that across these different churches. That everyone at the church agrees, usually one or two things, this is what our church does best. And then we ask the question, of these 16, which one would have to be strengthened for you to be more involved participating? Not one single one garners more than 15%. So you can try one or two or three different things. Realize that you're only going to tap into perhaps a few people because the world has changed, right? Now I can go and I can get jeans that perfectly fit my big butt. Or I can get my feet measured and get the insoles that exactly work for me. Right? Or I go to Amazon and they've already have selections of, you will like these books. Well, how many times in our congregations do we say, oh, well, there are four committees, pick a committee, or pick a ministry. Oh, you don't like any of those? Oh, I'm sorry, that's all we have. Oh, you really want to be in a choir? No, we have all the choir members we need. We live in a different world now. And this section on learning about these other dynamics that hinder participation and involvement, take some time to ferret out. This is where we talk about contextualizing this and looking critically, not just at the attitudes of individuals and why they're not involved, but what about our programs? What about the changes to society? What about those other factors that hinder our involvement in the life of this congregation? And how can we either kill some committees or change how we continue to mature our people in the faith, or put some big burly guys at the back door to make sure that people don't get out, right? I mean, some of us in here are UCC and we're famous for not guarding our front door. Well, you better guard the back door. That's the problem. If we don't create a group of people in the congregation that intentionally think about some of these issues, then we're going to assume it's our fault, or it's, oh, well, those stupid sheep, you know, they just don't want to come. It's not an either-or question. It's a both-and answer. Because all of that, as Robert Putnam clearly showed, right, is out there in society. And we have to find ways to, again, adapt and change and evolve to go along with what's going on in society.
And that's why we encourage you to create a learning team. The first three chapters of the book talks about listening and creating a listening team to hear the congregation, Now this listening team either briefs the next team or becomes the next team, the learning team, to begin to ask, okay, what are some solvable ways that we can make involvement and participation more readily accessible to our people? What are some ways that have come up in listening to the congregation that structurally, programmatically, is feasible, reasonable, fits within our theology to be able to say we can make this adjustment based on what we're hearing from people in order to facilitate greater spiritual growth? You have to hear what's going on in order to step back and figure out something proactive and positive that you can do. This is the first time in my life that I'm part, I attend a small church, my wife and I are very involved, but we're part of the 20% that's moving away, and it just hurts us, it pains us. And we feel like we're wearing a sign that says, would somebody please listen to us? Would somebody please engage us? And that's not happening. And there are so many practical ways that someone in leadership could step back and say, now wait a minute, there are people moving away in engagement, and can we listen to the common themes? Are there some valid common themes? And are there things we can learn from and change in order to better help them connect spiritually? It's kind of a two-step. It's letting all the squeaky wheels squeak for a minute, but then stepping back and saying, what's the bigger picture that we're hearing under there that we can proactively address?
And in fact, you have your listening team, and they've gone out and they've heard a variety of issues. You don't know those variety of issues necessarily until that team goes out and listens to some of those. And they may form certain patterns. There may be a whole host of folks who need visits and assistance with living and rides to the church or the communion to come to them or all kinds of things. In addition to, well, I want to overthrow the pastor or let's give us, contemporary music or something. But so you gather together all those patterns at the individual level. A learning team gathers, in a sense, another perspective on the life of the congregation at the kind of structural level, at the programmatic level, at the cultural level. And then the two teams begin to talk, right? Well, we have these sorts of things. Well, we have four retirement communities where a third of our people who are disaffiliated because they no longer have rides and there's a chaplain there, but they don't really feel connected to our congregation anymore, and yet they want to feel connected to our congregation. So maybe we should create a ministry to reach out to those people or to get a way to connect them, whether a satellite feed or who knows what. You don't really know the full contextual reality of your congregation and why those 50-60% of people hardly ever show up until you ask them and until you look at, well, do our programs that all happen in the evening take away all of our older adults who don't want to drive after dark? Or do all of our programs that happen during the day without childcare diminish the people who are home with kids and then would have to have, all their little ones running around? Until we ask those questions in relation to why people aren't coming or are coming, we don't fully know what the dynamic is that we have to fix. The more we can expand the ways and the dimensions of participation, the greater the level of participation is going to be.
Let me give you, as we go to our break, a very simple story of how this happened. New pastor came into a church near me. Church had been in decline for about 30 years. He called the church to pray. And to a series of times of prayer. During that times of prayer, he prayed too, but he also listened. He said, I went and I wrote down the things that people prayed for. And he said, I was overwhelmed at how many people prayed for the children of our community and the weak children's ministry that I, as a pastor, I thought was just fine. I don't have young kids anymore. I assumed everything was great. He said, From that, I learned that people have a real heart and passion for children's ministry, and their perception is that our children's ministry is a lot weaker than I was thinking it was. We put a lot of energy into the children's ministry, and I found a lot of ready volunteers, mainly the people that were praying so hard. And we have one of the best children's ministries in the community, and it's drawn a lot of families. It's just done a lot of good things. All that happened by, I don't want to underestimate the role of prayer, but listening in as the people were praying to hear what was something that the church could address. What is it at your church that people stand in line the most for? Okay. And if it's a good thing,
the restroom.
Is it something you can build off of? And likewise, what is it that's the hardest thing to get responsiveness for? And is it something you have to continue doing, or can you do it in a form that works best? Your job, especially in an existing church, which continually adds one more thing, and over time you just have a hodgepodge of vested interests, is to figure out which things you can benignly neglect and build around and create new momentum on something that there's responsiveness. Now, I heard you whisper church council. Let's talk about that for just a minute. In theory, people should leave their time on church council built up spiritually, feeling closer to God, more in love with their church, more aligned with the vision of the church. We could go on and say what should happen in theory. And so often, because of your joke, that isn't what happens. But you know, there's an awful lot about church council, or whatever you call it, that doesn't have to be done the way that it's done. I've heard of many churches that take a segment and they make that a ministry time one to another because they found that there is a responsiveness there and that works. I've known other churches that set agenda times and say, we're going to cover this in this time, and if it doesn't get covered, it will be moved to a subcommittee or something like that. But to figure out the odious parts and restructure. If nothing else today, we're wanting to bless you to rethink why you do certain things, and if they are not helping people grow spiritually, then think through how you might modify them to do so. Now, some things, like how the church council has done, may have been done that way for hundreds of years at your church. But it's like the pastor who was a new pastor, came in, the organ was here, the piano was there, and he thought, well, this is ridiculous. I'm going to move the piano over to the organ side. You already know, Aunt Minnie played there many years. And pretty soon, he had a new address. He came back to the church many years later, and notice the piano and the organ were both on the same side. So I said to the successor pastor, how did you do it? He said, well, that was very easy. I just moved Aunt Minnie 1 inch per week. She moved across the stage. And, you know, everybody's used to her over there now. You know, she's been gone for decades. Really, there are an awful lot of things you can change. But of course, you don't use the word change. We modify, we tweak it, we strengthen it, we augment it, we explore it. We don't change it.
We put it on hiatus.
And there are an awful lot of things you can try, not as policy, but, you know, let's let's experiment with something for the summer, let's explore something that you have implicit permission to do. But you do it that one inch at a time. And you're able, ultimately, since we're in this room, to change a lot more than you realize that you can. But start with what you do well, with what you think God is blessing. And also explore the things that seem to meet a need at a time, at a different era, a different culture, and aren't now. And how can you build around those things?
One of the things that we suggest in the third section of the book, where we talk about really leading, is to lead in an informed way, right? That's why it comes after the listening team and the learning team, because I think too often we lead programmatically because this book is the latest cool book, or it's the way I've always done it, or it worked at my other church and should work here. But in fact, those of us who are sociologists of religion strongly think that you need to think and understand the congregational dynamics and the congregational context in order to have an informed leading of that congregation. But as I said before, it's not just about what you know. It's also about what is God calling this congregation to do and to be. So you take what you heard and the patterns that you heard, and you take the patterns that you saw out in the culture and the needs of the community and the dynamics of the community, and then you sit before you do any leadership and your team prays over it and thinks about it, and is God, okay, we have these various needs, which of these do we prioritize? Which of these are really what our congregation is about? And so much of the dynamic that we talk about, especially at the beginning of this section, is, again, participation and involvement is a spiritual issue, and the leadership to greater participation and involvement also has to be a spiritual undertaking. It's not just, let's take this data and analyze this data and say, oh, 60% say this, so let's do that. If that's not who the congregation is, if that's not the vision of us as a people of God here, then leave it for the 64 other Episcopal churches within driving range. Leave it for two towns over to do the United Church of Christ stuff for that group. Think about who God is calling our group to be and do and to serve these people, and then make your priorities from what you have already gathered into leading into the future. One of the things I think that our analysis of the data and our reflection on what we learned showed is that far too few congregations raise the bar very high. We assume everyone's welcome, right? Open hearts. I'll pick on all the denominations. We want people to come and feel welcome to come into our congregations, and we want them to learn by osmosis what is required to be a good person in this congregation. We don't make our expectations of them clear, unless we're an evangelical church. And then we say, we know exactly what you should be doing to be a good Christian in this congregation. Now, I use mainline evangelical, but in fact, evangelical congregations have it slightly better because they do say there are specific things that are marks of a Christian and are very much similar to the marks of a Christian in mainline congregations, but they say it. They up front say, this is what is up. Here is where the bar is set. Aim for it. Oftentimes, I think we get frustrated because our people are not living up to the expectations that we keep in our mind and hold them accountable to, but never say out loud to them, hey, these are the expectations of a good Christian. We have a tendency to sort of want them to measure up to them in our head, but not on our vision statement, not on our call to worship, not on our commitment and membership papers. The more we set the bar higher, the more people are going to strive. And we encountered church after church, a church within a stone's throw here, said to me, our people are amazing. The higher we set the bar, the more people we attract to membership and involvement and commitment. They want to aim for something. They want their spiritual life to be meaningful, and part of that is to getting out of themselves, to doing something more than just the mundane, to doing something meaningful and of significance. Likewise, when you think about the lists, those things that are successful, what do they have in common? What is it about those that engender involvement and participation? And not just what do they have in common, but how can you do more of those? If, for instance, being a part of the choir is something that people really like to do, and there are other folks who really would like to do that, well, then find ways to make more choirs or make more space for the choir or put the choir out in the congregation so that they can be out there and then the spectators can be up front. If, as Warren said, there is a strong passion for ministry to the youth and to the Sunday school classes and to the children in the congregation and the children in the community. Find more ways to do that. Don't say, well, we have one thing and we already have all the slots filled, so I'm sorry you can't be a part. If the passion is there, then make it available. Likewise, as we talked about before, some of the barriers to involvement are a lack of training, a lack of gifting people, a lack of plugging them in once they feel like they have a gift and a calling. Well, then create a whole mentorship program where every leader in every committee has a shadow person that they are training to replace them, and then replace them. Upset the apple cart. Rotate folks. Put term limits on, right? It works in everything else. Just those things alone create greater levels of involvement. If a congregation rotates the people who are on committees, who are serving in leadership, just answering yes to that increases the level of involvement and participation. Simple things to do, right? Well, yeah, I can say that because I don't have brother so-and-so who's been on this committee for 84 years, and if you try to move him. So then, you know, put a little strychnine in his coffee. You find a way to celebrate, right, that person's involvement, give them someone
they
to mentor.
That too much, Scott.
Yeah. Give them someone to mentor. You have 40 years of leadership in this. Can you please bring along this younger, this 64-year-old person into your wisdom? Because, you know, probably the rapture's coming here. You're not going to live here that long. We love your willingness to be involved, so much so that we want you to communicate it to another generation. You find graceful ways to do some of that, but get it changed around. Start, you know, setting limits and those kinds. A lot of people say, and we'll talk about some more in the Q&A, as we said, people get involved in multiple different ways and in the passions that they have internally. So how do you in a smallish congregation create ways for 150 people to be involved in what passionately connects them and gives them a sense of meaningfulness? Well, we're going to talk about that in a bit. But that is a challenge, but it is an absolute necessity. You can't say, we have these four different places for you to plug in, and we want you to serve with joy and express your gifts. But I'm sorry, your gifts don't fit those four places to plug in. We have to be thinking beyond that. We have to think about these folks as individuals and empower them as individuals, and not just fill slots, but empower them in their ministry and in their calling and in their gifts.
Home Depot, for a while, had a slogan called, "You can do it, we can help." So often in the church, it's, "We can do it, and you can watch." Or, maybe we're very generous, "We can do it, and you can help us." But the heartbeat of the New Testament, and picking up on something Scott has said a few minutes ago, So much of ministry is tailored, just like our clothing and our Amazon purchases and everything else, to who we are. So what if your church took the attitude of you can do it and your church can help you? What is the ministry that God is calling you to? In that sense, there would be unlimited kinds of ministries. It requires a new kind of leadership, which is why this third section of the book is called Leading. Because you can't just let everything loose, nor can you just let squeaky voices and squeaky wheels be the determining factor of what God is calling your congregation to be. But after listening carefully, prayerfully, after learning about the greater context of your congregation, now it is time to lead. And the first step that we've experimented just a bit about is to identify what you do well and do more of it. You cheer that the loudest. You throw more prayer, more energy, more spotlight, more announcement, more whatever onto the things that are doing well. And you will see more of that. And likewise, the things that aren't going anywhere, maybe you can't kill them, but you can at least put them way down on the priority list. And in doing so, your goal is to create more opportunities for people to participate. And ideally, there should be far more opportunities to participate that people come up with than they're able to fill themselves. And this is not just activity for activity's sake, because the landing point of this book and of the research is the idea that when people are involved, they self-define and saying, we're growing spiritually. Kind of like defining happiness. You know, a surveyor may not say, this is what happiness is, but the surveyor will say, you know, how happy are you in life? And most people can say. Likewise, are you growing spiritually? How is this church helping you grow spiritually? People can say that. And the more that people can say that with more enthusiasm and confidence and specificness, the higher you're raising that bar, and the more they are involved.
We've talked briefly thus far about what's going on in the congregation. You know, what are your programs and projects and efforts, committees that are working, that aren't working? You know, do more of those. You know, shake those up a bit, all of that kind of thing. But in fact, that's still only addressing those people that are in your box. That's still only the 30 or 40, or maybe if you're lucky, 50% of the people who are your members that feel okay with that box. That's not going to address the person's comment in the far back who said, you know, my kids, I'm not happy here, and my kids have soccer, and they're not going to ever come. How do you lead that family? How do you minister and help develop their spiritual life? Well, you're still called to reach out to them, right? If not, some other congregation's going to. So how do you do that? Well, you do that in this day and age by thinking outside of that box. And everything we've said thus far pushes adaptation, creativity, new ways of addressing some of these issues, not just the interpersonal issues, but also the cultural and structural kinds of issues. So if the congregation has the issue of dealing with, and many congregations do have the issue of dealing with soccer games and baseball and softball and other school-sponsored activities, all that fall now on Sunday, how do you still reach out to those people who are happy to watch their kids on the sideline for 3 hours on Sunday morning rather than come into worship? Well, what this requires is for us to think in new and different ways about how we do worship, about what attendance and involvement in the life of the congregation means, about what giving means. Giving, you know, we hear stewardship, it's not all about money, but is that really what we practice? Likewise, small groups. Wow, be involved in small groups. That increases involvement and participation and spiritual maturity. Okay, but what counts as a small group? Service. Yes, we need to do service. But we have to begin to think in new and expansive ways about these things. So, to minister to the parents and the children who would rather be out on the soccer field Sunday morning. Well, perhaps someone's ministry in the life of the congregation is to go out there and be with them and to engage in conversation and meaningful talk about how do we develop the spiritual and the physical development of our children while we're standing out here talking and being involved in their lives where they are on Sunday morning. Or if we're talking about service and we can't get anybody to volunteer for our soup kitchen unless we twist their arms, well, let's flip it around the other way. How are they in service every day of the week? And can we count that as service for the congregation's outreach to the community? So, for instance, we came across a congregation out in San Diego, megachurch, rock church. They said, well, actually, what they say is, all of our ministries, all of our outreach have to be self-funded. We're not going to give any money from the congregation's budget for those services. So the people who serve in those are passionate enough to raise the funds, to volunteer, to give their time on their own dollar. But they also said, everybody here is a minister. Didn't I hear that somewhere? Everybody here is a minister, and everybody ministers 24/7. So how do you reach out to your community? How do you serve God every day? Let's count that. So the first time I think they counted it up, okay, they have 12,000 in attendance, 600,000 hours of community service. So what they did was take random acts of kindness and giving to others, whether it's picking up trash, taking somebody to the grocery store, serving in the PTA, all of those are acts of God out into the world, right? It's offering a glass of water to someone in need. And they counted that as part of the congregation's ministry to the world. But they didn't leave it at that. It's 600,000, that's great. Next year, let's try for 750,000. So they ratcheted it up, right? First, they celebrated it. Look at what our congregation does in the world. And then they said, well, let's do more. And in fact, let's give 100,000 hours to the city of San Diego. So they even targeted some of it. So now they're not just celebrating what everybody does, they're also raising it, and they're also focusing it in different places. And I think the last I heard was they were now aiming for 1 million hours of community service. That's expanding what it means to do social ministry through the life of a congregation. It's not about the church. It's about the gathered people together and what do they do and how do they do it and how do they gather. So Facebook, if a third of your people are on Facebook, think of it as a prayer group. Think of it as a support group. Think of it as a small group. If other people are out there tweeting each other at work, begin to think of that as a Bible study or any grouping, the committee structure that still exists in many of your churches until you kill it after this workshop. Do what you have to do by email. When you get together, support each other, pray with each other, vision what could we do with this committee. What is God calling us to do with this committee? Not, oh yeah, paper, yeah, yeah, shuffle, shuffle. We have the ability now to expand and enlarge and to think about our gathering and our ministry and our giving and our service in whole new ways. But only if we get out of the box of tradition that defines those things for a century ago. We're in a different world now, and we have to think about those things in different ways. The more we think about those in different ways, the more likely we are to entice the people who are outside the box that we see every week. But only if we let them know that we are now thinking outside of the box. You know, so they're not going to be there when you make the announcement, oh, and by the way, we're not going to count all of the hours that everybody participates in Sunday school or at at PTAs or on community boards. You need to put it in announcements, on the website, maybe send out letters to people. Let those folks who aren't there know that we're doing things differently now. Because if you don't let them know, they're not going to ever find out because, in fact, they never come. But they might come if they realize, oh, that's not the place that I thought it was. Look what they're doing. Look how they're rethinking what they do.
An illustration, one more. This church in Austin we went to, their small groups were just not exciting places. There wasn't much engagement. And they listened to the congregation, and they kept hearing this service pulse. So they said, why don't we ask each small group to include a serving component? Whatever you do as a small group, would you serve beyond yourselves? That connected. All of a sudden, in the months that churches began to engage this service component, there was a new life, a new vitality, and a new growth in the small groups. It came from listening and then saying, what's happening? And how can we give overall leadership to it in a way that promotes greater involvement, participation, and, as we discover each time, greater spiritual growth?
You ask if you expand this to include actions that we don't normally think of as part of the life of our congregation, how do you make the tie-in that what they do in the world is part of a Christian faith? In fact, you say, hey, what we're doing in the world, Christianity is not just the 9 to noon thing we do on Sunday. It's a 24-hour, 7-day-a-week thing. And the actions that you do in the world are inspired and motivated by all kinds of reasons, but in fact, you're living out what God is calling you to do, to the community group, to the trash in the park, to the person that needs clothing or food or the PTA that needs leadership. That is you, but it's you living out God's call on your life. You turn it into something spiritual. You make them reframe what they're doing as, in fact, an act of faith. The same as when we talk about stewardship. Stewardship is a broader idea than giving money, right? It's giving of time and talents. And essentially what you're doing is reframing for people a way to think about their giving to God, their giving to this congregation, in a more expansive way. And the same is true of service. It's the same as what you have to do as spiritual leaders to get out of that mode of what the church does or what we do on Sunday or what the official programs and outreach ministries of the church are is what counts. That's hogwash. It's what we do to our neighbor in the world every day that shows whether we're a Christian and we're living a Christian life and we're growing spiritually. All of us have to reframe that because we've had centuries of programming to think the exact opposite.
You're raising the question, if we redefine service in a broader way that seems to match where people want to serve, what do we do if they don't want to serve on the internal stuff of the church? The committees and the programs that exist?
It is a challenging question to think if we can't create any passion around something or there's no one in our congregation or a team that isn't willing to do this, do we need to have it? Okay, now some of you might be Presbyterian and it's mandated down from above. You got to have all these things.
But less is mandated than you realize. I've talked with many United Methodists, for example, who have taken their book of order and have said, well, these 6 different mandated committees could all be served by one combined committee. The bishop says fine, district superintendent, and they have gone back to a simpler model so that more people can be released into ministry. It takes leadership creativity, asking first, do we really need it? And second, if it is required, can we do it in a different way?
What you're perceiving is the 20 or 40% that are already there. And you don't even know the talents and interests and passions of the 60 or more percent that aren't there. Maybe they've always wanted to do this, but Sister so-and-so was always in charge of that.
That's what your listening piece is going to come up with, the how would you like to be involved in and all that. You're going to hear people say, well, if our church did this, I'd be the first to do it. And, of course, then the answer coming back is maybe God is calling you to lead that. You've asked what kind of leader can handle this. A lot of negative is going to come out by listening. And a lot of proactive change is going to ruffle a lot of feathers. And you said, talk to us about the kind of leader that can do that. Scott, why don't you talk to
us? two thoughts. Honestly, I think the characteristics of a leader that would do this is exactly the characteristics of the leaders that are in this room. By that, I mean, we're not saying go out and do 100% different, and you're going to get 100% involvement and participation. Anything that we mention in the book, if you try, may change it by 1%. And that's 1% positive. The idea of this is not revolutionary change. Okay, we're sort of presenting that in a sense. But the idea of this is just to think about it differently and approach it differently and ask different questions. And those do take risk, and they do take innovation and the challenge of maybe ruffling some feathers. But what is the alternative? The alternative is being happy with the 20 to 30, 40%. And I've looked at the data, and there are others here who have looked at the data, and in 25 years, a lot of congregations are going to be dead because they're not capturing the imagination or resonating with many of the younger generations. So they're not replacing those folks in congregations who are dying. It does take some willingness to risk and to risk failure. But from our work with megachurch pastors, every single one of them failed over and over and over again and just said, well, that didn't work. Let's do something different. You know, it does take a passion and a sense that God is calling us to minister to our entire flock. How do we do that? We begin somewhere. And if you don't begin somewhere, then in fact you're reneging on the calling to minister to the entire flock. Or you're saying, let's just minister to the easy members of our flock. You've spent some time listening to your audience, listening to the congregation, listening to people who hardly ever come. You've looked and thought about the context. You've tried to meld those two and come up with great leadership. Things seem to be working, and you rest on your laurels, and the next thing you know, you're back to square one again. All of what we try to do in the book is to create organizational form structures, as I said. Listening is supposed to lead to a database of, or some way to hold people accountable and think about, well, what is that person's trajectory in maturity as a Christian? So we constantly want you to think about embedding this in the life of the congregation, to track it, to get feedback, to understand if somebody comes and is there for a season and then starts to drift away, that you react to that and that you address the issues there. Or if there's a change that's taking place in a community and all of a sudden you begin to see people disappearing, well, then you have to continue to evolve. And it's not a one-time shot and then it's over with. It has to be embedded in the life of the congregation. If you make this tremendous push and change the structures and then stop and do nothing, Pareto wins. The 20% end up and the 80% are gone. It is a continual thing if indeed you want to defeat the inertia of the 20% doing all the work. As we said at the very start, this whole entire effort is not about bringing more people in. It's not about filling all the pews. It's not about filling all the coffers. It's about the church as a gathered community and about the Christian life being a gathered community. And that spirituality and spiritual maturity take place with others. We're not called to be monastics, right? We're called to be two or three gathered together. So God calls us to be leaders of this gathered community, to be shepherds of the flock, and to watch over them and to strive for their spiritual maturity, even as they strive to mature themselves. Our admonition about reaching out to the other 80% or perhaps the other 50% is not about numbers or about applying another program, but rather it's about attempting to faithfully live out God's call for your congregation. And that requires, in this day and age, new ways to do things, new ways to reach out, new ways to understand what it means to be a gathered community of Jesus Christ in this world and in this community.
Bottom line is, if you pay attention to your less involved people, they will become more involved. And they will tell you that they're growing spiritually. Let me just say that again. We're all in favor of reaching out. Absolutely. It's probably a little more work to reach in, to think about who is connected with this flock that we really should be caring for anyway. They may not eagerly accept our care, but can we pay more attention to them in a way, and if we do, they will be more involved, and they will tell us that they're growing spiritually. Some you reach out to and it may not work. Some may give you some pain as you listen. But ultimately, if you're called to shepherd a flock, remember Jesus' story of the 99. There were 99 and one wandered off. And he left the 99 and went out to retrieve the one. Today, it's like leaving the 20 to go after the 80. But if you do, maybe next year you'll only have to chase after the 70 or the 60 or the 50 or the 40. We want to give you hope that God has put you and others in your congregation in relationship with some people who have said at some level, I want to be shepherded. I want to identify with this flock. Well, if so, then take the energy, take the leadership to reach out to them, listen to them, and walk them back into the fold in such a way that they, as time goes on, say, I'm growing spiritually in a way that I never have. Isn't that what we all want?